This little light of mine.
Welcome to This Little Light of Mine, the podcast where we explore what happens when you teach a child that they are not allowed to love. Here's your host, James Powell.
Hello and welcome to episode 10 of This Little Light of Mine. My name is James Powell and I'm so glad that you're able to join me for today's episode, Beyond Shame. I'm super excited to share today's conversation with you, since I'm joined with Matthias Roberts, host of the podcast Queerology, which was named, get this, one of the top 12 LGBTQ podcasts by Oprah's Magazine O. Not only is Matthias a superstar podcaster, but he's also a therapist and author, and today he will be sharing some of his personal experiences with shame and insights from his new book, Beyond Shame, Creating a Healthy Sex Life on Your Own Terms. Before we jump into my conversation with Matthias, I want to give a huge thank you to everyone who left comments for This Little Light of Mine on all the many different versions of Apple Podcasts from around the world as part of our contest to win Matthias's book, Beyond Shame. Our winner? It's TO Listener 77 from Canada, who wrote, "I love this podcast. It speaks to often taboo topics and issues in an open, honest, and helpful way. James and his guests' personal experience give the podcast a refreshing level of authenticity. Can't wait to see and hear what's in the works. Keep it up." Thanks so much, TO Listener 77, for all your encouragement. Now drop me a DM at My Light Shines Bright on Instagram, and I can get your details and send you your very own copy of Beyond Shame. And now, without further ado, here's my conversation with Matthias Roberts. Welcome, Matthias, to This Little Light of Mine. I am really excited to have you here today.
Thanks so much for having me. This is great.
Yeah, it's great. It's great to have you here. So I'm new to the Matthias fan club. And but as soon as I was introduced to you and started looking into your work and what you do and what you stand for, I actually got a little bit emotional and sat back and said, wow, if someone like you existed when I was young, things would be dramatically different. And yeah, just reflecting on that, it blew me away. And so I'm so thankful that you're here today. And so for people who don't know you, how do you introduce yourself and what you do?
Yeah. Primarily I'm a therapist. That's kind of my main day job. I live in Seattle, Washington, and work specifically with folks who were raised kind of in religious environments who identify as queer now, or just folks who are kind of working with religious trauma or sexual trauma. That's a lot of my work. I also have a podcast called Queerology, which is a podcast that kind of sits at these intersections of faith and queer identities and exploring how those things kind of work together, but also this question of how do we live better as queer folks who have some kind of faith background. Usually leans mostly towards Christianity, but not always.
And can I toot your horn there a little bit?
Sure.
Because it's not just any podcast for if you're also new to the theist world. It's one of the top 12 best LGBTQ podcasts in 2020, rated by Oprah's Magazine. So he's a pretty big guy.
That one I'm like still giddy about.
It's amazing. When I read that, I was like, wow.
Yeah, I have no idea how they found Queerology, but my goodness, when I saw that, it was a dance party for days. So,
well, it might be because of your 100 episodes.
It could be. There has been a lot of episodes, and
a ton. Yeah. Such a huge amount of work. So congratulations on both of those.
Thank you.
Things.
Yeah, I have a lot of fun doing it. Yeah, and then I write and speak, kind of about these intersections of queerness and faith, but also, you know, sexuality in general, and so not just queer sexuality, but definitely inclusive of that, but just shame and sexuality and religion and how those things kind of intertwine to give us the kind of messed up, shame-filled sexuality that a lot of us are holding on to at this particular moment in time.
And so you talked about a concept, religious trauma. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard of that 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. How would you define that?
Yeah. You know, I know there's a formal definition for it, and I don't know what that is off the top of my head. So this may not be exactly it, but when I think about religious trauma, we'll even back up. So what we know about trauma is that trauma is created when something happens that kind of overloads our systems to the point that we can't process it in the moment. And then when that remains unprocessed in our lives, it can either be conscious or subconscious. It ends up impacting the way we live in our lives. So when we're kind of talking about religious trauma, we're talking about trauma that has happened within religious environments, whether that be within churches, within families, whatever, but around religion, of where we've been taught messages or we have been inundated with things that our bodies or our minds cannot cope with at the moment, and therefore leads us into having to dissociate. And it can manifest in a ton of different ways, but for a lot of folks, it manifests in leaving our faith communities or not wanting to have anything to do with faith because the messages that we were taught was so damaging, and we have visceral bodily reactions to those messages when we hear them again, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense. And I think the strange thing that I'm learning about trauma is sometimes you don't even know that it's there.
Right.
And when you've lived in that environment, that becomes your baseline.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until this year in some very deep therapeutic settings that it started to point out to me. And I was like, what? Mm-hmm. And so going into things, I always thought trauma was 9/11,
right,
a plane crash, or seeing something tragic happen to your parents, or something like, I guess, capital T trauma. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I never thought of trauma as being that broad. Mm-hmm. And yet what I'm learning is the long tail effects of trauma are the same.
Right. It's one of those things where, I mean, we can say with some certainty that every single person on the earth has experienced trauma in some forms. Like, we don't escape trauma in our lifetimes, but so often it's so much easier to think of that, those big capital T traumas, and think, well, I didn't experience that, or even I wasn't technically abused. Like, that's a huge one. I for me, as I was working with my own stuff, of like, I was never technically abused, at least in my definition of what abuse is, and yet there's a lot of the same symptoms. They may not be as strong, right? They may be very normalized. But once we start doing the work to kind of uncover those things, we realize, like, in some ways, our lives have been formed around these experiences, and we have no imagination or no conceptualization of how different and better life could be once we kind of face those things and work through them, reprocess them.
Mm-hmm. And I guess what I'm also realizing is that trauma is not being able to show all of yourself,
right?
Having to hide your emotional self, your spiritual self, your psychological self, and that fear of, if I show you who I am, you won't love me. Right. If I show you who I am, you'll kick me out. Mm-hmm. And those types of things. And I think so many queer children, especially growing up in faith-based communities, that's their normal.
Right.
And that's what they hold on to from a day-to-day.
Right. Yeah. I mean, one thing I often hear in this work is isolation is inherently traumatizing. We can also say emotional isolation is inherently traumatizing. So there may be people around us, but that not being able to show ourselves, that builds up over time. And that's what can lead to complex PTSD, which is very different from PTSD, which is induced by a single event. It's much, much, much deeper in ourselves. And the reactions can look very different. So, and that's not to say that we all have PTSD. that's not to say that. But there are there's subtle differences between, like, kind of long-term environments of trauma versus single events. And both are very valid.
Yeah, somebody sent me an email recently, and it was, I don't know, I had so many mixed emotions as I read through it, and it was a very familiar story. Mm-hmm. I grew up in the perfect home. My parents provided everything. There was no issues. There was no trauma in my life. And then I guess it got deeper down into who they were, but I can't let my parents know that I'm gay. I'm in my 30s. I'm this, I'm that. And I'm like, it's funny because I resonate so much with that, because I, in the past, have just been like, oh yeah, that's fine. That's just how we grow up. That's just kind of the normal life of a queer child. Mm-hmm. And yet I now know how damaging that is. And yet we don't look at it. We're just like, no, my parents were perfect. We had the, I joke with my family, with our pals, that we were, my friends would always nickname my parents June and Ward, because we had that kind of perfect Leave It to Beaver image. Totally. And so I kind of took that on of like, well, yeah, there was nothing wrong. Right. It was me that was wrong.
Right. Which is a very normal response, right? Because when we're kids, we don't have the ability to be able to say our parents are wrong, right? We don't know anything different. And it would actually be an act of destruction to be able to say my parents are wrong. So the only thing we can do to hold ourselves together psychically is to turn that on ourselves and say, I must be the wrong one.
Yeah, not only our parents are wrong, our faith community is wrong.
Yep.
Our God is wrong.
Yep.
And it's interesting because even as adults, we can have those conversations and kind of see the shades of gray, but it's still difficult as adults. And I remind people that these kind of rational conversations where you can kind of go and pick those different threads apart. And then I remind people, I'm like, so have the same conversation with a 7-year-old. And then they kind of pause and they're like, oh yeah. And I'm like, that's what that 7-year-old is wrestling with inside their mind, inside their body, inside their soul.
Right.
And that's where, that's part of the reason why I started doing this podcast, is to help those children.
Yeah.
And so why did you start Queerology? Where did that come from?
Similar reasons, to be honest. So when I first came out when I was 22, right after I graduated from like a conservative Christian undergrad, and pretty soon after I came out, I had this real sense of, I don't want anyone to go through what I went through. I don't want any kid to have to go through what young Matthias had to go through. And there weren't a ton of resources out there at the time. It was just pre like Matthew Vines, who wrote a book called God and the Gay Christian, which kind of in some ways blew up this conversation, right? But this was before Matthew kind of did his thing. There were only a few people kind of talking about this, these intersections of faith and being queer. And so I started blogging. And eventually, as blogging kind of became the thing that no one did anymore, and I was meeting a ton of people, I started realizing like, oh, a podcast might be a really cool way to be able to like talk to all of these different people with all of these different life experiences, and not just focus on this, how do we square this with the Bible? Because I mean, that's an important conversation, but like for a lot of us, we're at the point of where we're ready for more than that conversation. And I wanted to show folks who may still need that conversation that there is a life beyond that conversation too. Like there are queer folks who are living integrated lives, happy, fulfilling lives, who have held on to their faith and who are just queer as hell. And all of those things work together. So that was kind of the inspiration behind Queerology. And I like the mechanism of like someone can put headphones in and listen to it privately, no matter where they are in the world. 15-year-old Matthias in rural Iowa. I mean, that would be a safer, at least, thing for me to do than getting a book even. So
what was that like growing up as a young boy, and how has that shaped your life now?
So my family was deeply conservative, very religious. I always say borderline fundamentalist, because we were kind of right on that line of almost being fundamentalist. I was homeschooled for religious reasons.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Until what grade?
All the way through. Yeah.
Wow.
All the way through up until college. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And you call that in America borderline fundamentalist. In Canada, we call that full blown. So. I'm like, does it get more fundamentalist than that?
Yeah, believe me, it does. Like, my sisters were allowed to wear jeans, so that kept us from being fundamentalist in some ways.
See, these are the stories that when I talk to my, and I'm using air quotes, secular friends, and for anyone listening, people that do not know Jesus as their personal savior and go to church multiple times a week. Right. When I talk to my friends, who I now call just normal people, when they hear stories of like my... We were cool because my sister could wear jeans. Like, they think that I'm making this stuff up.
Totally. Right? Yeah. But no, not at all. That was a huge debate in our homeschool group, whether it was okay for women to wear pants or not.
Wow.
And there were families who believed it was wrong for women to wear pants. It was quite the world in rural Iowa homeschooling groups. And it was in the midst of that I started realizing that I was gay. And of course, I didn't have that language for it. I didn't really even know what it was. I think I knew the word homosexuality because that's, you know, the word that pastors used or whatever. And I had some inklings that that's what I was feeling. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that. So that was about 11, 12 years old that kind of started to surface. And I mean, I immediately knew that there was something very wrong with me. I think it hit most particularly when I was in my Boy Scout group and I heard some of the guys talking about their feelings for women. And it clicked that, oh, these are the feelings that I'm feeling towards them. And then I was like, oh, that's what this is. Like, I think I'm sexually attracted to men. And so I tried hiding it. I tried praying about it. Like, that was kind of in the height of Exodus International and Focus on the Family. These big ex-gay movements were really kind of like, I mean, they were like full-blown conferences and all of these things happening in, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s. And that somehow, I mean, indirectly had permeated my entire world. And so I knew it was wrong. I knew it could be changed. And so I just decided I would pray about it and beg God. And eventually God would take care of it and I would become normal and everything would be fine. And obviously that's not what happened.
What do you mean that kind of stuff permeated your world?
Well, it's weird because I can't think of specific moments of how I learned these things. I think I can think of moments later, like once my parents found out and once they kind of started doing research, like I can think of very specific moments of when it kind of solidified. But those kind of early years of realization, I don't know how I knew that it was that there was something deeply wrong with me. I don't know how I knew like this is going to send me to hell or this can be changed. It's just a phase. Like all of those things were things that I somehow knew, but I don't know how I knew them. So my only answer right now to that is like that messaging kind of permeated my world in a way that I picked it up indirectly and yet knew it very well.
Because I think that's one of the things that confuses my parents because they ask me the same question. They're like, well, we didn't teach you that. We didn't sit you down. And I look at back at them, I'm like, well, what do you mean? That was everywhere. It was in all the magazines that would come from Focus on the Family. It was in the church bulletins. You would see all, like, it, just in our ecosystem as a young child, it felt like it was everywhere. And the more I talk to my parents now, the more they're like, wow, we had no idea. And at that age, I personally thought that I'm like, wow, everyone in the church knows this is a setup waiting for me to kind of spill it. And they're all kind of in on this like
totally
outing process. And I was so paranoid. And it's neat hearing somebody else talk about that experience too.
I mean, even down to like, I have memories of my mom, like when we were like watching like The Amazing Race or some reality show when there would be a gay couple and just like the subtle scoffs from my parents. Like just those, I mean, those things that they may not even know that they were doing, but I so distinctly remember because I think something in me identified with that.
Yeah. And it's those small things that children lock into. Because my specific memory is in Canada when the first legal same-sex marriages in the world were happening back in 2001. I remember the pastor, Reverend Brent Hawks, who was on a previous episode, was leading that. And I remember sitting in the living room with my dad, and he made some kind of comment similar to that scoff. And it's those small things, right. Like they don't have to be massive. And I remember one of my dad's best friends using the F word to talk about queer people. And just that sinking inside of like, wow, I respect that man. He's one of my dad's best friends. And it's those small things that you just unfortunately lock
pretty
into.
Much so.
How's this formed your work now? Like, is that what kind of propelled you into this vocation?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think a lot of this, like, this isn't what I planned to do or even really dreamed of doing. I think a lot of it came out of just my own quest to figure out things for myself and then realizing, like, okay, now I'm equipped with all of this. Mm-hmm. I need to do something with it. Like, and I want to do something with it. I want to help people,
right.
Or at least journey with people alongside kind of as they figure things out. And so it wasn't the plan, but I'm so happy I'm doing it. It's deeply fulfilling work for me to see folks find freedom.
Right.
Yeah. So it very much influences it, but it wasn't, I set out to be a graphic designer. Like that's what I went to undergrad for. Yeah. So.
Oh, really?
That was my plan. So.
Well, that's why your website looks so good. So speaking of helping people, if you were a father and were raising, call it a boy girl twin set, and they were 11, kind of approaching their tweens, knowing what you know now, what are the top three things that you would want them to take into their teenage years that would help them?
So there's a few things. So there's this concept within a theory called attachment theory, which is one of the most researched psychological theories out there as to how human relationships develop. And one of the key tenets of it is we're going to make mistakes no matter what. It's what happens in the repair of those mistakes is what makes the difference. If someone can attune and realize a mistake was made and then, you know, come to another person and resolve that in a way that is kind of mutually beneficial, that's what kind of makes or breaks relationships. One thing that I would hope is that I would be able to attune to my kids in a way where I could notice the small things. I think that's something that I've had some conversations with my mom about, of saying, like, this is not a critique of my mom, and I guess in some ways it is too, but for queer kids, most mothers know when there's something wrong with their kids. Most mothers can see the slight misattunements, and it's whether they respond to those or not. And I mean, that's where a lot of trauma can come from. And so when I talk about my kids, I would hope that I would be able to see when small things were happening, where small misattunements were happening, to then be able to resolve those and talk about them. So that's one. There's another one. There's a researcher by the name of Dr. Tina Shermer Sellers, and she wrote the foreword to my book, Beyond Shame. She's currently in the midst of writing a parenting book about how you talk to kids about sex. And one of her concepts is this idea of 10,000 tiny conversations. And her whole kind of thing is like this idea of having like a sit down and having the talk about sex. Like,
right.
It doesn't work. Instead, we have to have like 10,000 tiny conversations, a minute or less, to kind of normalize and talk and open up curiosity. I really like that concept. That's something I'm going to have to learn when I have kids. I don't know how to do that. But that idea of having open conversation throughout, developmentally appropriate conversation throughout the years, instead of having like a, you know, 13 years old or 16 year old sitting down and having the quote unquote, the talk. That's another one that feels huge.
Wow. That is a massive one. The province where I'm living, they tried to bring in a new sex curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought it all the way down to kindergarten, and people lost their minds. You cannot have the talk with my children.
Right.
And as I hear you kind of talk about it, it's like, well, they weren't trying to have the talk with a 5-year-old. Mm-hmm. They're trying to have maybe 100 of those 10,000 conversations.
Right.
And how do you sprinkle those in as they grow up? So it's not just the talk.
Right. It's so important just to even begin to normalize the fact like something's going to change in our bodies. And for that to have been talked about with kids, because that happens with kids at many different ages. Right. And it can be terrifying. Yeah. So that's one that, like I said, I'm going to have to learn how to do, but I want to be able to do that with my kids. And I think a third one, and this is one that I'm still trying to work out in myself, because I think there's a sense of, you know, because I'm not a parent, so I don't know this world, but I remember hearing from my parents, like, we will love you no matter what. Unconditional love, no matter what happens. And in some ways, I know my parents still deeply love me. Like, that love hasn't gone away. And yet, there's this sense of it turned out to be somewhat conditional. There's a conditionality to that love. And I think I'm still trying to figure out the inner workings, because there's a lot of complexity in this sense of what happens when your child forsakes like the fundamental beliefs that you hold. Like, that's hard from a parental perspective and from a kid's perspective. Like, both of those things are hard. So that question of what does true unconditional love actually look like?
I wonder if what a lot of parents are actually saying is, we will provide for you no matter what. And it's like, we're not going to kick you out. We're not going to cut off food. And I think that's what offended my parents so much when I told them, well, I couldn't come out because I thought I was going to be kicked out. Yeah. And they're like, well, we were never going to. And yet there is, and it's very complicated, because there's no but after that. And there's a huge but after, we will love you no matter what.
Right. Right. Because the quality of love changes. And in some ways, this is a whole rabbit trail, but in some ways, and I think about it, like, if I were to put it into less kind of stark terms, at least when it comes to LGBT issues and in church, but like just other areas of life, in some ways I think, like, well, how could it not change? Right? Because I think a lot of relationship is built on shared values and interests. And I've also seen a lot of parents do it very, very, very well. So there's something mixed up in there that will probably take a lifetime to kind of sort out. But I would hope to be able to offer a sense of unconditionality, of you can come to me no matter what, no matter what, and I will be here for you, to my kids.
Yeah. Do you want kids?
I don't know. I go back and forth on that. Yeah. Yeah, we'll see.
We talk a little bit about your new book.
I'd love to.
Congratulations, by the
Thank
way.
You. Thank you.
Yeah, so tell us about Beyond Shame.
Yeah. So Beyond Shame, creating a healthy sex life on your own terms. It was really kind of birthed out of a quest for my own understanding of sexual ethics. So I was raised, like many folks, kind of in this world that we're now calling purity culture. This kind of movement within the late 80s and early 90s that put a huge emphasis on committed heterosexual marriage being the only place where sex could occur. And within that context, anything goes. But outside of that context, it's sin, and it makes you impure and like an abomination to God. And so there's not much nuance in that. There's not much room for what for what healthy sexuality is. It's healthy sexuality is more something that you do by getting married instead of anything else, right? So as I came out and kind of started, you know, wrestling with all these ideas of what actually is a healthy sex life, and I was never taught this, and, you know, started researching sexuality from both a theological and a psychological standpoint when I was in grad school, and the amount of shame that I felt about my sexuality, some ideas started coming together, and I started seeing clients and seeing folks everywhere I went who were raised in these same kind of cultures and environments who hold massive amounts of sexual shame. So Beyond Shame is a book on kind of how do we work with the sexual shame that we've been given and how do we move forward into more healthy sexual ethics in a way that's not prescriptive. That's not a here's a healthy sexual ethic, but instead, how do we discover that for ourselves?
I guess that's one of the things as I learn and grow and evolve, that's so uncomfortable. Because the way I was raised, similar to you, it's like, well,
right,
no, give me the manual and I'll perfect it. But you talk a little bit about you decide and you choose your values. And that kind of concept, I was like, whoa, that's
right.
I don't know, Matthias, like,
right,
give me what they should be and
right,
I'll try to do my best or I'll whatever. And I think that is like, it's very challenging for people growing up in a evangelical fundamentalist background where they're more, from my perspective, dictates on this is what you must.
Right. The sense of here's what the Bible says and here's what you must do. I mean, that's that's what I was raised in. And I mean, even that subtitle, the creating a healthy sex life on your own terms, like when my publisher gave that to me, I was like, oh, is that the book I wrote? Like, and I'm like, well, I said I wanted a provocative title. Like, there it is. So, but there is a sense of, I mean, I deeply believe as we really start to get in touch with our own selves and we get in touch with our values, of course they can look different, but a lot of times, like, our values end up being very similar. Mutual respect, pleasure, happiness, love, like these things that in some ways, not always, but in some ways are kind of universal to a human experience that are...
I'm not comfortable with pleasure, though, that one.
Really?
That one's off the table.
Okay. I'm like, is he serious or not? Like, do we need to...
like, and let's cut this interview short.
But a lot of times there's a, and I hear the way that I'm talking with my former conservative ears and being like, what in the world am I saying? But values are deeply personal, and yet there's often a universality to them. Like, I'm not saying like, oh, you can go choose to like be, I mean, you can go choose to be deeply selfish with your sexuality, but then the question would be, why are you choosing that? Like, what's behind that? How do we do work with that? Deeply interrogating what our values are to figure out why they have been shaped the way they are. That leads us forward onto a path of towards health that I think is deeply synchronous with scripture and what Jesus calls us into.
And I also think too, values are, it's a look inward.
Yeah.
And when you're looking inward, that's where God is. And those are the things that come together. And I think that is a big shift from a lot of the external views of give me the manual, give me the workbook, give me the this, give me the rules, give me the verse that I can follow. And I remember a specific time, and I was actually laying on the psychiatrist's couch and just saying, just give me the frickin' rules. Yeah. And I'm like, I know what the straight purity, if I was married, rules would be. But I look out into the gay community and it's no holds barred. And I remember just being like, it was such, I'm like, give me something that I can work with. Like, how many people is normal? How many times is normal? Like, what is this? And I wanted somebody else to define normal for me. And the journey in that desert was years.
Yeah.
Until I've realized, well, no, you do get to decide. No one's going to give you that book. They'll give you their book, maybe, right, but no one's going to give you your book.
It's a movement from measuring ourselves against something, you know, comparison, and trying to strive to fit something, no matter what that is, into a level of autonomy that it is terrifying.
Well, and it's so counterculture, because the joke when I hear you, well, if we're not measuring against someone, how will we know that we've won?
Right.
And that concept of in order to win, someone else has to lose.
Right.
And I think what you're talking about is that evolution in everyone gets to win. Mm-hmm. There isn't a loser.
Right.
Or the person that's losing is the one that is going outside mm-hmm. and letting outside define what it is for them. Mm-hmm. So what did you learn about yourself writing this book?
Oh, a lot. One thing I realized is just how still uncomfortable I am talking about sex and sexuality, which is fascinating. Like, and that still continues. Like, as I do all these interviews, like, I still realize, like, there are parts of me that are like, oh, this is what I'm going to talk about. And that's fascinating to me. And I think another thing that I learned was just like the level of freedom there is in the world, and even within our Christian tradition, how, like, I was taught, like, it's high stakes. You know, you're either in or you're out. You're either pure or you're not. You're following the rules or you're not following the rules. And like, there's a breadth of tradition and a breadth of kind of spaciousness within our sex lives, just like there is in many other areas of our lives. And the question is, mm-hmm. can we tap into that and allow ourselves to make some mistakes, to figure things out, to realize that it maybe isn't this super high stakes thing. Human sexuality is a normal part of human experience, and it takes some figuring out.
And I think what struck me as you said that is it's the human side. That's what confused me. And I think what confuses a lot of children growing up is children listen to the branded message. Yeah. They listen to what's being said behind the pulpit. They listen to what's being said on the pages because that's all they have access to. Mm-hmm. But I would agree that if you sit most people down and get to know them and they open up, they're like, well, yeah, that's what we say over here. But in reality, this is how I get along with my partner. This is the arrangement that we have. This is what I like. This is what, and I think it's how do we understand and help people get more human with each other and share those experiences. And that's what I'm appreciating so much about conversations like this and allowing to listen to queerology and listen to a lot of these things, because that's not what I had growing up. Mm-hmm. And I think it shows a lot of the more individual human side of use your imagination. Yeah. Go within. What would love do?
Right.
And let's design that together. Mm-hmm. Let's create that for you.
Right. Because it's going to look different for every person because we're different people.
And that's okay. Mm,
yeah. It's a very...
And so who's this book for? Is it just for queer people of faith? Mm-hmm. Or?
No, it's not. It's marketed to folks who kind of grew up within religious messaging around sexuality. So folks who grew up within purity culture, mm-hmm. mostly. Of course, it's deeply queer inclusive. Like, that is, I mean, at the heart of the book, but it's also a path forward for anyone who struggles with sexual shame, or at least religious sexual shame. But I would even think outside of like religious sexual shame, I mean, sexual shame is a kind of universal experience. And hopefully it charts a path kind of forward, or at least a path towards thinking about it more.
And I think that's really important to note, that it's not just queer people of faith that own the monopoly on sexual shame. Mm-hmm. I think it's, or I definitely know it's way broader.
100%. Yeah. Much broader. Yeah.
Before we wrap it up, like one of the quotes that you talked about was talking about sex and intimacy, mm-hmm. and how sex can help with intimacy or can help avoid intimacy. Yeah. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So I think I use the word vulnerability there, which, I mean, in some ways are interchangeable here. That sense of we can use sex for intimacy, we can use it to avoid intimacy. In the book, I talk about sex requires vulnerability, but also can help us avoid vulnerability. And I use Gaber Mate's definition of vulnerability. He's a medical doctor in Vancouver,
BC. Canada.
Yeah. and in one of his books, he defines vulnerability quite simply as the capacity to be wounded. Which, for as much as I've read like shame and vulnerability researchers, like that definition like hit me at the core. because it felt so stark. This idea of, am I opening myself up to the potential to be wounded, or am I closing myself off from that? Mm-hmm. And we can use sex for both. Sex can be a deeply intimate thing and deeply vulnerable thing where we're inviting someone into a place of where we could both be wounded. We can also use it to close off all of that vulnerability, to get that dopamine rush and to kind of dive in and not have to deal with the vulnerable parts of ourselves. And that's one of the paradoxes. Like, both are true. And so then to be able to start to kind of play with that and navigate it and question ourselves on, like, why am I doing this? Why am I running off to this hookup? Or why am I avoiding sex with my partner? Is it because I don't want to be vulnerable? Or is it because I want to actually open up and potentially be wounded, which is hard?
And I think that's a misconception. And I speak of this from being deeply involved in it in some sections of the gay community where it's, well, I don't have any problems with sex. I have a lot of sex. And that kind of view of sex as sport versus sex as connection.
In some ways, I mean, this is where things start getting really complex. But in some ways, like, there are parts of me that I want to say, and there's nothing wrong with that. And are we aware of what we're doing to ourselves in the process?
Mm-hmm.
Are we aware of the parts that we're kind of cutting off or avoiding when we're doing this? Like more of that question of why? Why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm. But I think even before why, your original question was, am I aware that I'm doing this?
Yeah.
Because I know my personal story, I walked into a lot of those situations just thinking like, oh, this is it.
Yeah.
And not even being aware that that's what I was doing until years later. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It sits in this. So at the beginning of the book, I kind of talk about three coping mechanisms that we often use to manage sexual shame. Shamefulness, where we let our shame control our sexuality. Shamelessness is where I think this kind of vulnerability equation comes in, is a sense of where we're using sexuality to control our shame. So we may be having tons of sex and we may actually be practicing the values that we hold, but we haven't actually done work on our shame. And so we're suppressing our shame with our sexuality, but the shame is still there. It's still the driving force of what we're doing. And until we start to work with that shame, we're not going to feel satisfied, healthy, or good necessarily about our sex lives. It's going to be that kind of sense of constant running, at least for many people. I don't want to speak in permanence, but...
I can relate to that, no. And it's exhausting.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the way that I kind of explain that phenomenon to my parents is that sadly it's like the noose that gets placed around your neck as a teenager that just gets tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter.
Yeah.
And you don't see the impact or the effects until years later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why it is so important to have people like you doing the work that you're doing and sharing the way that you share. Mm-hmm. So I'm so thankful for having you here and the work that you do.
Thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Okay. So we wrap up with 5 rapid fire questions.
Oh, great. Okay.
So get ready. Okay. The really easy ones. How do you define God?
Love.
Nice. What advice would you give back to the 8-year-old you?
Let yourself feel.
That's a good one. What's your dream for the church over the next decade?
I think in tandem with that definition of God as love, I would dream that the church would be able to step more fully into love. And not just some like dreamy, airy concept of love, but tangible love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are the top 3 ways you practice self-care each week?
Bubble baths is a huge one, which I know people knock bubble baths as self-care all the time, but I'm telling you, it's legitimate.
And what bubble brand do you use?
You know, it depends on the day. Like,
that's
a little collection. community is a huge one for me. Just having folks around me that I can turn to who know me deeply, and who can that back to that conversation of attunement, who can attune to me in ways that go to the kind of the core parts of myself, that one is huge. And then alone time. I'm a pretty big introvert, and I realize like if I don't have that time to sit and process and kind of be by myself, things don't go well. So those three are huge for me.
Yeah, nice. And if you could gift the world one thing, what would that be?
Gift the world?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
My brain's going to world peace. Compassion, I think. And again, not to be airy, but I think like, at least here in the States, I think that's something we're losing quickly. Is a sense of compassion and empathy. And I would hope for some renewed sense of that in our world.
Absolutely. And finally, where do people find your work?
So I'm across the internet at Matthias Roberts, Matthias with two T's. My website is MatthiasRoberts.com. You can find Queerology wherever you listen to podcasts. And then my book, Beyond Shame, is available wherever you buy books.
Nice. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I look forward to getting to know you and working together as the years go on.
Likewise.
And again, the work that you're doing is so incredibly important. And I appreciate you. And thanks for being here with us today.
Yeah, thank you. It's been fun.
I'd like to give a huge shout out to Matthias Roberts for being generous with his time and for sharing so vulnerably with us today. I really appreciate when a therapist, author, or expert on shame is able to walk the talk when it comes to vulnerability. The definition of vulnerability that Matthias shared with us today talks about our capacity to be wounded. Like Matthias, that shot an arrow that pierced my soul and gives me some really clear goals to work towards when I think of my own healing path. I've been a big fan of Brené Brown for years and have used her definitions around vulnerability in my own life, with my teams at work, in coaching, and in consulting engagements. She defines vulnerability as the birthplace of innovation, creativity, and change. She says that we cultivate love when we allow our most vulnerable and powerful selves to be deeply seen and known, and when we honor the spiritual connection that grows from that offering with trust, respect, kindness, and affection. As I take a step back now and look at vulnerability as my capacity of being wounded, I can see how cleansed, socially acceptable, and corporatized these definitions are. The capacity to be wounded is next level. It's raw, messy, and it puts everything on the line. It's also the exact antithesis of how I was taught and how I taught myself to live my life. My entire life objective was, don't let them see how hurt you are. So what about you? Do you live your life from a place of vulnerability? Are you opening yourself up to the potential of being wounded with your friends, your family, or your partner? And what about at work? Do you approach your job from a place of vulnerability? Or do you go into every situation with your battle shields up? We live in a society that worships certainty and control so that we don't ever get wounded. We always hear things like, don't ask a question that you don't already know the answer to. Have a contingency plan for your contingency plan. And don't ever let them see you cry. But what if we flipped that switch? What would our world look like then? What would your job look like? What would your relationships look like? Who would you be if you lived beyond shame? Thank you for joining us today, and I look forward to connecting with you in 2 weeks' time for our next story episode called God Hates Figs. And no, it's not an episode about fruits. Well, actually it is an episode of what I was taught that God thought about some fruits. But side note, did you know that a fig is actually a flower and not a fruit? Anyways, thank you for being with us today. And before I go, I want to remind you, your story is important. You were designed with a powerful voice. We need to hear what you have to say. You matter. You are needed. You are wanted. and you're loved.
To learn more about our guests today and for links from our show, visit www.thislittlelightofmine.ca. If you enjoyed this episode or feel that it could bring love and acceptance into someone else's life, please like, rate, review, and share so that we can build our community and bring more love into the world for all people. Thank you for sharing your time and listening to our stories today. And we would love to hear your story too. Visit the Get Involved section of thislittlelightofmine.ca to share your voice. We love being in community with you and look forward to sharing more with you next time. Now go and let your light shine bright, because you are loved. Let it shine.